Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you could join me this week to talk about cardboard, well, collecting. Valuable cardboard. The hobby, of course. You still have the cards in various boxes and binders, perhaps stacked up on a shelf somewhere. And you still hang on to them, maybe because there is some financial value to them, or more likely some emotional value to them. Or you just haven't cleaned out the closet recently. And you know what? Sometimes that happens. And that actually is part of the reason why we're doing this particular type of show this time around. And I was inspired by a number of different reasons to kind of change it up just a little bit this week. Although, to be perfectly honest with you, maybe in the next few cycles of the show, we work this kind of listener mailbag into the programming wheel. But I decided this week to just kind of open it up to you. If you had any questions or comments, we were going to do basically just a listener mailbag. And that's a little different than normal. You know, normally I find a pack or some packs and open them up and talk about that particular brand or that particular year in collecting, or as we do with all the packs, we'll find five or six cards in each pack and talk a little bit about the players at the end of the show. And that's all good and fun and people like that, but just wanted to mix it up a little bit. So I opened up the floor to you, had a couple of really, really good thought-provoking questions come in, and also a response to a topic we talked about in the previous episode, the SSPC set of 1975-76. And in fact, it was the person who asked about it following up with a comment, which I opened up to you, the listener, again, talking about great first memories of collecting. And that's something that if you hadn't had a chance to read the question or respond to it, I would be curious to hear your responses, because I think that's a key part of collecting, whether you collect now or you collected years and years ago and you don't really do as much now as you did back then. We all have a first impression made that sticks with you for many, many years to come. So we'll discuss that as well. And you may be asking, Matt, how did you come up with this particular type of show? Well, it's quite honestly, it's for a number of reasons, which we'll get to in just a moment. But first, I do want to remind you that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday during the off season. So that means our next show will be coming your way 2 weeks from today. That is Friday, January the 25th. And if I've got some packs to open, we'll do it via video link on YouTube and through our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, the day before. And you know, who knows what we're going to be talking about, but I do have some idea in what direction we're going to go in with that particular show. But regardless of what we do on the next show, know that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every couple of weeks, and it comes via our home base, which is Audio Boom, but we also transmit the show out through many other methods, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, also Spotify and Google Play. And there are various other companies that will spread out podcasts everywhere. So I again encourage you, if you enjoy the show, to spread the word for me. If you, especially if you listen on iTunes, there's an opportunity for you to rate the show. And if you, you know, rate it, if you feel it's you know, worthy of giving all the stars you can give, then please do that, because that actually helps promote the show internally within iTunes. But feel free to spread the word via Twitter or message boards, you know, whatever method of communication you have with all of your collecting friends, because it is certainly a good thing. Word of mouth helps out an awful lot. And, you know, we're not just talking about collecting today, but we've got a full archive of shows that goes back a few years now. We've had over 100 episodes, and the show started with me going set by set, year by year, starting in 1981. And throughout the course of the show, we basically have a report card on every set that was made, every major set that was made, I should say, going back really until about 1949. which is something that we were able to patch up this past summer, patching up some old Bowman and Topps cards that I did not have in my collection. We were able to do that. So check out the archive as well, not just the new shows that come your way every couple of weeks, but the archive too. And we can use your support in keeping the archive nice and healthy. If you would like to make a cash donation to Wax Ecstatic, you can do so via our PayPal account. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. Any money that you contribute goes straight into the show, whether it's maintenance of the website Audio Boom or the archive as well. That's where that money goes. Or it goes to the purchase of packs and other cards to discuss on the show. It does not go into my pocket. It does not go into my kids' allowance. It doesn't go into my wife's Target purchases. It goes right back into the show. So know with confidence, whatever you donate, whether it's $2, $20, or heaven help you, $200, if you got a few bucks available and you survive the holidays and would like to donate that to Wax Ecstatic, it is going to a good cause to keep this program up and running and in good shape over the next few months. Now, speaking of the holidays, is, pretty much collectively the big reason why I did this listener mailbag approach to the program, because I don't know about you, but the holidays just totally screwed me up. And it tends to happen, doesn't it? You know, the kids are out of school, you got to entertain them or find somebody to entertain them. Your work hours are all messed up. If you have family coming in or you're going out to visit family, for me, working for the Tampa Bay Lightning, our team just happened to be on two West Coast road trips. So right before Christmas and right around New Year's, the team is out in California or in Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg. And that means that here in the Eastern time zone, the games start a lot later. So sleep patterns are off and I'm holiday shopping and you name it. It just gets to be a real mess. Well, one of the interesting things about the holiday time, though, even though my routine is all off and I didn't really get a chance to go out and purchase some packs like I wanted to, the interesting thing is I did manage to have a little bit of downtime at the house. And I pulled out the big old monster box, and inside the monster box, one of the rows, I have my 86 Topps cards. And as I mentioned in a previous podcast, I just on a whim decided, you know what, I should probably put together the 86 Topps set. I'll hand collate it. I'll do it the old-fashioned way, the way that I prefer, which is buying packs and opening packs and trying to collect it that way. And then once you get down to the final seven or eight cards that you just can't, you know, get through packs, then you buy the singles somewhere. So I have probably, I don't know, maybe like 450 of the 86 Topps cards, and they're sitting in the box there. And I looked at the other four rows, and it dawned on me, and this wasn't just over the holidays. This was actually probably a couple months ago when I started the 86 Topps endeavor. I look at the other rows, and I realize, you know, these are all cards from 1981 to 1987. And whenever I bought a pack from any of those years, I would open the pack, your star players would get separated, and everything else just ended up in this box. So I realized, you know, this box could probably use some organizing. So over the time span of probably 4 or 5 hours throughout the holiday weeks, during some additional downtime that I had, I went through and I took every set that I had, or cards from every set that I have. I don't have any complete sets from the early to mid 80s. And, you know, pulled out all the duplicates, put them in a box, found somebody, in fact, one of our listeners who is, you know, a big collector, good guy, and I said, hey, before I put it to market, do you want these for such and such price? He got a real steal. You know, he's got 930 cards from the early 1980s. And I, kept singles of all the other cards, and I managed to, you know, create some space, which is good. I accomplished something in the organizing of my cards. And that is something, if you have stacks and stacks of cards, you know what I'm talking about. They tend to continue to stack up. And then you get in over your head and you're just like, holy crap, I've got 10,000 cards to go through, and I got to organize them and put them in sequential order, or however you organize your cards. So I was actually kind of proud of myself. I'm like, all right, I cleaned this up a little bit, and you know, found a home for all these other cards, and you know, an appreciative buyer. So that's cool. But as I'm going through the box, I'm thinking about just some of the cards and some of the players that I pulled, and you know, some of the memories I had too. And you know, we're talking, you know, 81 Fleer, 82 Tops, 83 Tops, 84 Donruss, you know, all the sets from the early to mid 80s. And you know, I'm thinking back to some of the shows that we did and some of the reaction to some of the sets. And it just got me thinking, you know, even though things haven't worked out to where I've purchased some new wax or found some individual cards that I want to talk about. And I do have some packs still sitting here in my studio. Granted, they're from sets that we have seen before, like 82 and 83 Tops and 85 Donruss, and we'll open them again. But, you know, even though it didn't work out to where I could acquire something new, I thought, well, you know, just kind of going through this box and looking through, you know, the history of the cards here and you know, kind of bringing back some memories of previous shows. Well, maybe I should just open it up to the listeners. So I did that earlier this week, and you all responded, had some great questions. And I wanted to share some of those questions, my thoughts about them. And of course, if our listeners have any thoughts about them, you're more than welcome to chime in via our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, one of the questions that was asked, really thought-provoking question here, comes from KevMoK21. And Kev, I'll call him, was the other sleuth who helped us decipher the precise wire photo that Topps used in the 1956 Hank Aaron card for the action shot, which was clearly not Hank Aaron. It was actually Willie Mays. And we were able to find a picture from, I believe it was 1953, from the French Getty photo archives of Willie Mays sliding into home plate at the Polo Grounds. Of course, Topps doctoring it up, just kind of slapping on this generic looking Braves jersey and calling Willie Mays Hank Aaron, which is quite the compliment, although Hank Aaron, not too shabby of a track record either. Well, anyways, Kev asks, of the flagship Junk Wax era sets, 89 to 93, and here's the caveat, other than Topps, what brand has aged the best in your opinion? Fleer, Donruss, Upper Deck, or Score? Now, that is a very interesting question, and we had a few fans who chimed in. Some ignoring the Topps caveat, and they would name, you know, 91 Topps, which is a great set. But let's stick by Kev's original question here. From the Junk Wax era set, and he sets the margins at 89 to 93, other than Topps, what brand has aged the best in your opinion? Fleer, Donruss, Upper Deck, or Score? So, Kev, a great question. I was thinking about it, and I just kind of mentally went over every set or every manufacturer throughout those years. And you can find some good sets and some good cards for each of them. So let's do process of elimination here. 1989, really a good year for most of those four brands. Of course, Upper Deck, that was their first year, and they reset the bar in the hobby as to what a premium card should be. And as I mentioned on previous episodes, it took the industry a good 3 years to catch up to Upper Deck. And at first it was with premium sets, and I still believe that Top Stadium Club was the best of the premium sets after Upper Deck to really match and, in my opinion, exceed what Upper Deck was doing. And then by 1992, all the other companies, their base cards were, you know, kicked up a few notches to be a little more premium than standard cardboard baseball cards. So, you know, Upper Deck was certainly great in 89. Fleer and Donruss, I thought, had good sets. Score, I was never a big fan of in 89. Even though I loved their 88 set, I thought 89 just fell flat. It was a very boring set. So you go to 1990. I'm a huge fan of the Fleer set. And again, Upper Deck was, you know, good. I liked Score. even though it has a very 1990 feel to it. Donruss, well, we all know about 1990 Donruss. You can still get packs for about 20 cents a piece online. The exploding ketchup design, not very popular for many fans. Let's fast forward to 1991, shall we? If you had the exploding ketchup in 1990 Donruss, you had the exploding mustard in 1991 Fleer. That was by far one of their worst sets. I don't think it's the worst. 1982, in my opinion, is the worst. But 91 Fleer, not that good. 91 Donruss, much like 1990 Score, even though it was very quirky and looked the times, I actually liked it back in the day. Score had a good design, but it was a mammoth set, a 905-card set, way, way, way bloated, and there's just too much of it still out there today. And then you had Upper Deck. 1992. Donruss ups its game, puts out a very good base set. Fleer, I thought 92 Fleer was an outstanding set, and I've actually been kind of looking around. That may be one of the packs that we open up. Yeah, I know it's junk wax time, and you may not like that, but 92 Fleer, I just don't think it gets the credit it deserves. It's a beautiful set, and you've got some really good young stars that come out of that set, some good inserts as well. 92 Score often gets overlooked. It's a good but not great set, but because Score's parent company was putting a lot of the focus on Pinnacle, the Score brand would very quickly wither on the vine, and I think 92 Score gets overlooked. And part of it, too, is because 91 Score was just so big and bloated and a little too 1991-ish. The 92 set's actually very clean. And then you have Upper Deck doing what Upper Deck does. And then by 1993, everyone's upped their game. I thought Donruss had a really good set in 93. Fleer, I didn't buy a whole lot of cards from Fleer in 93, but it was a decent set. And Score, I bought some 93 Score too, a very clean set, good looking set. But again, you know, the parent company kind of dropping the ball on that one, so that set gets overlooked. And you have Upper Deck doing what Upper Deck does. And by 1993, I think Upper Deck answered the call, the challenges from the top stadium clubs and the Fleer Ultras and the Pinnacles and the Leaf, Leaf Studio cards, you know, a very, very polished high-end base set. So that's the overview of all those four sets from that five-year time period. So which brand do I think has really outlive the others? Well, I have to say Upper Deck, and that probably doesn't surprise anybody. And for two reasons. One, Upper Deck is still around. You know, Upper Deck is still producing cards. They were, up until 2010, one of the officially licensed baseball card producers. Upper Deck's been doing hockey and some other sports over the past few years. And of course, Upper Deck was in a much better position than some of the competitors because of the investment that it got, the cash infusion at the very beginning, because they were able to sell their cards at a higher price. They were able to get a little more off the top of the production. And despite lawsuits, too, especially with co-founder Dwayne Bice early on in the day, the Upper Deck brand was financially able to weather some of the storms, and also through the cannibalization of all the other brands, was able to survive. Now, granted, Upper Deck now is not like Upper Deck of 1989, so a lot has changed in 30 years, but the Upper Deck brand is, I would say, the strongest of those four, simply because it still survives. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're going, well, Matt, you know, there's still Donruss brand out there. Yeah, but, you know, Donruss is basically part of the Panini company. I've said before that I'm not a big fan of, you know, the logo-less and wordmark-less baseball cards. I really think Panini is just playing up purely the heritage of Donruss, you know, throwing the old logo out there, throwing some old Donruss designs out there. It's not very innovative. If you're going to resuscitate a brand, then you need to create something from that brand and not just stick with nostalgia. Case in point, look at Bowman. Bowman, which started from nostalgia, trying to harken back to the 53 set, which was not very popular, the 89 Bowman set, you know, eventually became the set of the rookies and, you know, rookie cards of rookie cards, you know, guys who, as I've said before, 3, 4, 5 years away from the majors. If that's your type of card chase, then Bowman is your set. And that's been the position that they've had for about 25 years now. So, you know, if you're going to bring back a brand like Donruss, you got to, you know, actually invest in it and come up with something creative. Don't just slap an old logo on an old design and go, hey, look, Donruss baseball's back. Woo. So, I think Upper Deck, in a contemporary sense, is still the strongest of those four. And I think just, you know, looking back at that five-year window, I think you have to go with Upper Deck for a number of reasons. First of all, because it did set the bar in 89. It also set the bar on not only what a premium set should look like, but what an improved base set should look like. And even though Upper Deck was upending the industry in the late 80s and early 90s, it took a few years for the other companies to figure out, hey, we've got to come up with an answer to this. Because as the hobby boomed and as it was ballooning before the bubble popped, you just had your Tops and your Scores and your Donrusses and Bowmans, you know, just cranking out same old card after same old card, while Upper Deck was clearly far and away, especially in 89 and 90, the clear winner of design, of insert cards, of chase cards, of just premium quality over the standard baseball card. And even though the other companies by 1992 and 93 started catching up to Upper Deck or surpassing them in some aspects, Upper Deck consistently put out a great product. And especially if you look 89 to 93, Upper Deck, even though some people may say, well, the 90 set's kind of boring, or the 91 set looks like the 90 set. And yeah, there were, you know, some sets did kind of blend into each other. But think back to that time when you went to a hobby shop or a drugstore, grocery store, wherever you got your cards from. When you went to the store and you had a selection of cards to choose from, selection of packs. When you selected an Upper Deck pack, you knew what you were getting. You were getting high-quality cards. You were getting high-quality rookies. You were getting high-quality inserts. You were getting the hologram little stickers that were coming inside. You were getting the tamper-resistant foil packaging. You knew that you were getting a better card. And from year to year, you knew that you were going to get a card that was going to not only look good when you opened it, but could retain some value down the line. Granted, Upper Deck cards from this time period now, in many cases, are not as valuable as they were back then. But still, if you have the choice between an Upper Deck Randy Johnson rookie card and a Score Randy Johnson rookie card, if you're looking for value, you're probably spending that extra $2 on the Upper Deck than the Score card, which, you know, in many aspects is a dime a dozen these days. But, you know, there was consistency. And yeah, the design, you know, some people will equate consistency with boring, but there was consistency. You knew what you were going to get from Upper Deck each and every year. The other three companies in this question, Fleer, Donruss, and Score, you didn't know what you were going to get. You know, a little Forrest Gumpism right there. It was like a box of chocolates. And I think the best example is Fleer. You know, they had a good set in 89, they had a good set in 1990, and then they released the banana peel disaster of 1991. Same thing with Donruss. You know, I think 89 Donruss is actually a very good set. And it's a very valuable or a good value set, I should say. You know, you can get boxes and packs extremely cheap, and you can put together your own set and have a pretty good rookie class and a pretty nice design of cards for just a few bucks these days. But you know, after 1989, whoops, here comes 1990. And then, as one of our listeners called the 1991 set, the Christmas sweater set. Yeah, the ugly Christmas sweater. That's what 91 Donruss looks like. So, you know, Donruss flailed for a couple of years before righting the ship and putting out some good sets in 92 and 93. So again, Kev, I think the brand that has really outlasted all the others is Upper Deck. And again, not just in a literal sense as in they're still around, but also in terms of that particular time window you were looking at. So thanks again for the question. Really good question there. And I appreciate you sending that in there. We also had some really nice responses to that, and you can check that out on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, another great question from Doug McCready, who's stirred up the hornet's nest here and there every now and then. And I'm kidding, Doug. you've asked some great questions, made some great points here, and you've got another one here too. He asks, has the demand for older cards really gone down that much? In the 80s, when I went to shows, I had to pay big money for cards from the 50s and 60s. Now, they are a fraction of the cost. List the reasons you think. I like the SAT approach to the question there. And I won't list them, but I do have several ideas as to why the vintage cards, if you will, why they may not be valued as highly as they once were, say 25, 30 years ago. And there's a number of reasons for that too. And the funny thing is, as you know, Doug asked this question, and I'm thinking of a few reasons. And then Doug kind of answered his own question a little later on in the day. So I'll get to Doug's answer in a little bit. But there's a number of reasons why I think some of the 50s and 60s cards are actually a lot easier to get. They're a lot more affordable. And I don't think it's because of a lack of interest. In fact, I think the interest in vintage cards is actually going up. But one of the key things that you mentioned in your question, Doug, was in the 80s. Aha. So now we're just talking about the market then. And you have to kind of look at, as much as a lot of collectors don't want to do this, you have to kind of look at baseball card buying and selling and trading like the stock market. All right. When there is, supply and demand, you know, if there's, huge demand and a low supply, the value goes up. If there's a large supply and a low demand, the value goes down. And of course, when you're buying and selling stocks, you know the old adage, you buy low and you sell high. So when the hobby took off in the, we'll just say mid-80s, early to mid-80s, when it took off, and people were seeing this as less just collecting and more a chance to turn a buck on some old baseball card collections. Well, what do you know? The demand goes up and the supply is what it is. So let's say it's 1989. Let's go back 30 years ago. It's 1989 and you find a card from 30 years before then. So 1959. Let's name any player from 1959. All right, Hank Aaron. You find a 59 Topps Hank Aaron. And let's just say, for argument's sake, that the Beckett book value of a 59 Topps Hank Aaron card in 1989 was, I don't know, $100. So you go to a show, you find a Hank Aaron card, it's $100, you pay $100. All right, you got your Hank Aaron collectible. Now, here we are in 2019. You go to a show and you see the exact same Hank Aaron card. It's in the exact same condition as the one you bought 30 years ago for $100. But you see the seller has it priced at, say, $75. And if you're willing to negotiate, or if he's willing to negotiate, you haggle him down to like 65 or something. And you walk away with that exact same card at a, we'll just say 35% discount. Let's say you talk this person down to $65. Now, again, I don't know what the true value of a 1959 Topps Hank Aaron card is. I'm using $100 just because it makes for easy math. So just bear with me here. But the point is, 30 years ago, the card you paid $100 for Now you can get in the exact same condition at a 35% discount. You're going, well, what gives? Well, is Hank Aaron any less popular now than he was in 1989? No. Is a Hank Aaron card from 1959 any more scarce now than it was in 1989? Perhaps by a fraction, because over time, you know, a Hank Aaron card here or there gets thrown out in the trash or gets burned up in a house fire or something like that. So does the 59 Tops Hank Aaron population shrink a tiny bit? But, you know, certainly not at the rate between 59 and 89, you know, the years when, you know, kids would slap glue on the back of the card and stick it in a scrapbook and, you know, pretty much totally destroyed the value of the card. So, you know, that's not the issue there. But I think one of the big issues is, as I mentioned before, it's just market conditions. In 1989, the hobby was booming. Investors were throwing cash at baseball card collections, hoping that they would increase in value so they could sell them down the line just a little bit. So the dollar value of these cards goes up. The market has considerably cooled over the last, we'll say 20, 25 years. And really, the value of the card overall goes down, even though there is still a market for it. So I think part one of my answer is just the market. Will the time come where speculation in baseball cards rises again to the hysterical levels that they were in the late 80s and early 90s? I highly doubt it. In the sense of people paying whatever it takes to get a card. I don't think so. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't extremely valuable cards that are being produced and are being tracked down. Case in point, Shohei Ohtani. Okay, if, you know, that's the only reason why I was able to buy Topps Heritage cards this past year, the 2018 set. I could only buy packs up until about May 1st, because once the variations and the autographs and the different color inks that Shohei Ohtani used to sign these certain cards, you know, the market saw the different variations and drove up the prices. And then all of a sudden, packs and blaster boxes and hobby boxes, you know, the price tag goes through the roof. And I don't know about you, as much as I love the Heritage set, I'm not going to spend $200 on a box of 2018 cards. I'm just not. So, you know, I think there's still a case where you've got some current cards that will jump in value to similar proportions of some of the purchases you may have made 30 years ago. But I think overall, the industry, you're probably not going to see that. Now, another factor in this, and actually one of our listeners responded to Doug's question with this answer, and I wholeheartedly agree. Let me get the listener's name here. That was Jay Hollow mentions all those 50s, 60s cards owners are aging, no one to hand them down to, declutter liquidation as they age out. That is part of it, and it's not just aging out, but it's also just the fact that people who bought cards en masse 30 so years ago, it's less aging out and it's more decluttering. And it's kind of like me with my monster box going, man, I just gotta clean this crap up. And I actually heard this from one of the dealers at the last show I was at. He had this big monster box full of, it was mostly 1976 Tops. There was some 77 in there. And if I had all day to be at the show, I would have gone through all of the rows of all of these boxes and come home with probably a couple of hundred cards, because there were some star cards in there. Now, granted, these weren't PSA 10 cards. These were cards that had slightly rounded corners. A couple of them have some creases on them, or maybe some ink splotches from the printing press. And you couldn't get a PSA 10 rating for these. But he was selling these for, I think, what was it, like six for a dollar. So I can get a 76 Topps Joe Morgan or a Mike Schmidt or, you know, a Johnny Bench. Granted, probably at a PSA 3, grading, for 20 cents. Of course I'm going to do that. So as I'm shuffling through these cards and pulling out some good players and, you know, just small talk with the dealer, another person comes up and asks about a certain wax box or a certain set that the guy's selling, and he's selling it dirt cheap. You know, it's something from the early 90s, and he's just like, oh, you know, it's for $5. And the customer says, you know, oh, I used to buy these for 20, you know, back in the day. And the guy's like, you know, tell me about it. I used to buy this for $30, and now I'm selling them for $8. And, you know, that's part of it, too. It's part of the market condition as well, as I was talking about, where because the market has cooled off considerably, even dealers who bought this stuff in huge quantities a long time ago, they just want to sell it just to get rid of it. Case in point, as I'm going around looking for wax to open up and also for some cards for myself to purchase, you know, I saw there was one company that had a case of, what was it? A case of 88 Topps vending boxes. So we're talking, I'm trying to remember how many boxes were in a case. I think you got 18 of the 500 count boxes in a vending case. They were selling it for $50. Now, the shipping and handling, that's where it gets you, because I mean, it's a case. So, you know, there's probably like $60 worth of shipping. But still, I don't know what I would do with 9,000 1988 Topps cards. But, you know, that case cost a little more than $50 back in 1988. And when the hobby was really just churning along in the early 90s, that case that you probably bought for $65, you could have easily sold for maybe $100. But now it's down to $50, and like I said, you're probably paying more for shipping than you are the actual case of cards. But it's not just collectors aging out, it's also just decluttering. And I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing some discounts on a lot of the junk wax era stuff, is the collectors who hung on to these sets and these boxes and these cases for 20, 25, 30 years, hoping to turn a profit, they look at it now and go, well, I just want to break even. Let me get rid of these cards. And even I personally went through that, although now I kind of regret selling these cards. But 5 or 6 years ago, when my wife and I were in the process of moving out of an apartment into a home, I had an unopened wax box from 89 Topps and 90 Topps and 91 Topps. And, you know, I had some cello packs and rack packs, and they were just sitting in my closet, just doing nothing. I didn't open them. So, you know, I sold them on eBay, and I sold them in such a way to where I basically broke even. And, you know, given where the hobby is, and you're not going to make a lot of money selling junk wax era stuff, breaking even is a win. You know, it's basically just get it off my shelf. But going back to your point, Doug, about cards from the 1950s and 60s, that's another reason, in my opinion, that you see, you know, again, using that 59 Topps Hank Aaron for an example, you know, a seller for a card that was valued at, again, you know, let's just say for argument's sake, $100 in 1989, he just wants to move it out of his collection, bring in a few dollars, find somebody that's going to be happy to have that card. So why not sell it for $65? That may be what the collector paid for it, or the seller paid for it back in 1989 or prior to that. But he's just getting it out of his collection. He's getting some money back for it. It may not be a great return on investment, but he's still pulling in some revenue. And that's ultimately what you're trying to do if you're running a business, or if you're trying to make just a little money on the side, selling some cards from your own personal collection. Now, I think another factor in this is PSA grading. And I don't mean to pick on the PSA company. There's numerous companies that do this, Beckett, BBCE, you name it. There's several of them. You know who they are. And because the grading of cards, which really cropped up in the late 90s, because that made cards so exclusive, not only do I think it drove away some collectors, myself included, because all of a sudden there was a rich collector and a poor collector. You know, there was a great divide because the people who could afford to have cards graded and, you know, raises the value of them. Well, if you couldn't afford to have the cards graded, getting one in mint condition, you were now paying through the nose to get one. But that's a topic for another time. But I think the grading of cards has also driven down, generally speaking, the price of some vintage cards. And here's why. When you look at graded card values, what numbers of graded cards are listed in most price guides and most reliable pricing sources? You see a 10, you see a 9, you see an 8, in some resources, a 7. But after that, once you're talking a grade of 6 or below, that's essentially just ungraded book value. It's roughly the same amount. So if you send in a card, and let's just say, you know, this 59 Topps Hank Aaron, if you turn in this 59 Topps Hank Aaron to get graded, even though you think it's an 8 or a 9, and the grader who, you know, is working 9 to 5 and looking at hundreds of cards a day, and it's 4:56 in the afternoon when he gets your card, and he's just like, Christ, this is the 300th card I looked at today. It's a 4. And he slaps that case on it and puts that sticker on it that says 4. Well, guess what? Your much-beloved 59 Topps Hank Aaron card that you paid $100 for in 1989, if it's a PSA 10, it's $1,000 today. Well, guess what? You got that big old number 4 emblazoned on that case that you can't crack open. And now that card is valued at whatever the book value is, which might be, you know, $50. So now you're really stuck. You're like, great, you know, here's this card I paid $100 for. I thought it was worth $1,000 because this schmuck put a 4 on it. Now it's $50. So you're willing to get rid of the card at that price. All right, here, I'll put it up for sale on eBay for $40 and see if somebody bids it up a few dollars. So that drives down the price because, especially with vintage cards, finding a true PSA 9 or a 10 for a 60-year-old card is damn near impossible. Somebody had to take very, very good care of that card way back in 1959 for it to stay in a PSA 9 or 10 value range or condition all these years later. So I think the card grading industry has devalued some of these cards, or maybe not devalued, depressed the market in some of these cards because, again, you may have a card that's in great shape, but somebody, and because it is a vintage card, they're going to nitpick it. They find one tiny, tiny flaw, and that knocks it down from an 8 or 9 to a 4. And like I said, the value, once you get down below a 7, it's essentially book value. And so, you know, that brings down the cards a little bit too. And I've seen some really nice cards. A friend of mine was actually sharing with me, I think it was a 57 Topps Ted Williams card that was rated a PSA 3, I think. And he and I were poring over pictures of this card, trying to identify the flaw. And we saw maybe one minor little thing here or there. But, you know, giving it a 3, we thought was a little harsh. You know, I'm looking at it going, well, maybe you go 6 or 7. But because it was graded 3, he was able to get it at an insane value. And when you look at a 57 Topps Ted Williams, which is number 1 in the set, in pretty darn good condition, but somebody puts a 3 on it, I mean, you know, well, why not get it for, I forgot how much he paid for it, I want to say, you know, $100 or whatever, but, you know, it's the first card in the set. It's Ted Williams. It's 1957 Topps. You know, let's not get too over-anxious over the conditioning of the card here. So I think that's brought the value of the card down as well. And then finally, Doug, and again, this was such a great question here, another reason why particular 50s and 60s cards are brought down is because the emphasis now is on the superstar cards. It is those Ted Williams and Mickey Mantles and Roberto Clemente's and Hank Aaron's. You know, it's all the big star cards from the 50s and 60s that are going to be valued more. But the emphasis is also on the early, early cards. So a 52 tops mantle is certainly going to sell, you know, for high dollar because it's a 52 tops mantle. But maybe a 62 tops mantle, for all the reasons I stated before, while it's still Mickey Mantle and one of the top players from that era, you can probably find a good deal, be it a card that is rated a PSA 5 instead of a 10, or you find it from a seller that is just looking to declutter or at least pass on the cards to somebody else, and you can still get some good values there. So, Doug, a great question again. There's a lot of layers to that onion, and like I said, you actually kind of answered your own question. In fact, your response to Jay Hollow's point about owners aging out. You said that's the main thing. There are cards that clearly have real antique value and will only go up in price. 52 Mantle is an example. The rest are driven by the hobby and demand in the industry, opposite of what we thought growing up. Well, again, if you treat it like the stock market, that's kind of how stocks, you know, work. You know, it's a speculation business. And that's unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case may be, you know, what the hobby became in the 80s and 90s. And there is still speculation, no doubt about it. But I think it's more on the current items as opposed to the vintage stuff. So, Doug, it may be frustrating for collectors, you know, again, using that 59 tops Hank Aaron example, where, you know, if you paid $100 for a card 30 years ago, now you're seeing it sold for $50 or $60. It's frustrating because you go, wait a minute, I paid top dollar for it back then. But I think on the positive side, if you're looking to buy vintage cards, again, buy low, sell high, if you're looking to buy vintage cards, this is a great time to buy them. And whether you're getting the, you know, monster box of 76 Topps cards that are slightly abused for 20 cents a piece, or you're getting a 59 Topps Hank Aaron 35% off, you know, what the book value is, this is a good time to do it. And I've been absolutely thrilled to go to card shows and, you know, find some, you know, again, slightly beaten up cards from the 1940s and 50s for $1 or $2 a piece. Because again, I'm not too concerned about the condition or the resale value. I just think it's really cool to have a handful of cards from, you know, 1953 in my hands. So that's kind of the upside to it. Yeah, you know, maybe you're paying, or, you know, your card is not as valued as what you paid for it many, many years ago, but there's still a lot of value in the cards that you can buy now. And while I don't think you can, you know, pay off that mortgage with a handful of common 1954 Topps cards that you pick up at the local baseball card show, I do think this, you know, there are no, you know, 1959 Topps cards being made anymore. You know, it's 1959, and the population of those cards does slowly decrease as time goes on. So if you have some of these cards, even if they're common players, even if they're in slightly abused shape, you can still have a nice piece of history to either sell, you know, in your own time, 20 or 30 years from now, or pass along to your kids, your grandkids, you know, donate them to a museum or what have you. I think it's neat to have a piece of history. That's how I look at some of these older cards. It's a piece of history that I can buy for a dollar a piece at a baseball card show. And as long as I can get that, you know, incredible value as a buyer, I'll absolutely take advantage of it. And in terms of star cards, you know, don't worry about the value of the cards you bought years ago decreasing. Look at it the other way. The value of the cards you can get now are incredible. You can get some really impressive cards from the 1950s and 60s, even earlier. You know, you can get some really impressive cards at some very good prices. Will they raise up as high or as quickly as they did back in the 80s and 90s? Probably not. But again, if you're, you know, spending money for that card that was made 60 years ago, that's not going to be made anymore, over time, it will very slowly increase in value. But at the very least, your return on investment, I think, is going to be even greater, and you can score some cards that you probably never thought you could have gotten 25 or 30 years ago because the market was so high. So again, Doug, thanks for the question there. There's some great stuff there. Lastly, I wanted to bring up, in our last show, we talked about the SSPC set from 1975-76. And the set, if you didn't listen to that show, the skinny version of that story is the guys behind TCMA, the company that basically innovated the minor league baseball card set in the mid-1970s, they didn't like the flashy Topps cards of the mid-70s. So in the winter of 1975-76, they decided to produce their own set of cards designed similarly to the 1953 Bowman set. And they released some promo cards, if you will, in sheets that you could find in magazines. And eventually, this was going to build up to a set. It was actually a pretty large set. I want to say it was 600, maybe 700 cards. And a long story short is Topps, of course, caught wind of this, and they shut it down. And through the agreement that Topps had with the TCMA guys, basically said, all right, you've released some of this product. We're not going to have you recall it, but you can't produce it anymore. So there was some scarcity, and there is some value to that 75-76 SSPC set. Now, I mentioned that at a recent card show, I saw one of those SSPC cards. I passed on buying it, even though it was dirt cheap. And it was a Willie Mays card. And a quick little sidebar, I did a little more research on that Willie Mays card. That particular card that I found was not from the 75-76 base set, if you will, that TCMA released. It was actually from a promo. It was kind of a trial balloon set of cards that they issued in magazines during the summer of 1975. So it was a little bit of a, you know, just a trial balloon of, well, let's put this out there and just kind of see what the response is. I think they had 2 9-card sheets that they released, and this Willie Mays card was one of them. So again, if I get the chance at the show to buy this card, I'll buy it, not necessarily because it's a set that I want to chase, but I think it is a kind of a unique piece of the hobby history, and especially in the mid-1970s, which was the exact same time that Fleer was loading up its guns to take down Topps and eventually get the opportunity, along with Donruss in 1981, to sell an officially licensed product through Major League Baseball and the Players Association. But the person who originally brought up the topic of the SSPC set, John Cronin, added also a note on the SSPC set that I remembered, that I first discovered the set as an insert in Dynamite magazine, which came in a 9-card uncut insert when you open the magazine. Amazing what comes to your brain. And he's absolutely right. It's amazing some of the memories that come back. And that sparked my memories. And I originally had written back that, you know, much like John remembers the SSPC set coming through the uncut pages in Dynamite magazine in 1975. And isn't it amazing, you know, 44 years later, you're remembering this particular moment in time. I asked the question to our listeners, and again, I encourage you to follow up with this. You can tweet at Wax and Gum Stains and tell us your story. But what was the first memory that comes to mind of collecting as a kid? So not necessarily the best, not necessarily the most valuable card, but chime in with the memory of your collecting days as a kid, the one that first comes to mind. And in regards to John's comment about the SSPC set, the first memory that came to my mind, and I remember it like it was yesterday, it was 30 years ago though, I remember the time when my mother asked if I wanted to buy some baseball cards. And, you know, I had never collected cards before. My older brother did, certainly not as voraciously as I did. He had a couple hundred from the early 80s. But, you know, I remember the grocery store. I remember the time of the year. I could tell you the location of the exact store. I think it's still open. And I could tell you where in the store the display was. I could tell you what the display looked like. I can remember my reaction to the question. I remember my reaction to opening the cards up and just right then and there, just being hooked for life in this hobby. And it's just amazing how, you know, 30 years later, this is how it goes. And a similar story, I would say the second story that comes to my mind, and I've shared the story before, is, getting the Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card from a pack of 82 Donruss that I bought back in, I think it was 1990 or 91. And that was the first big card I ever got, the most valuable card I ever got, one of the first vintage packs, or I shouldn't say vintage, older packs that I bought when I was a kid, didn't have a whole lot of discretionary cash to throw around. So this was kind of a big deal. I normally didn't have $5, $6, or $7 to buy a pack of old baseball cards with, but that's another memory that comes to mind too. And I still have that card and it's still locked away. And I know, kind of like to Doug's point about, buying cards now that are valued less than what they were back then. The Cal Ripken card is the exact same thing. I think when the hobby was booming, the card was valued at about $100. Now it's valued at like $30. But I don't care. That was the that was the big hit that I had when I was just, 13 or 14 years old, and it was such a big thrill. So I asked the question, who else had a first memory that they wanted to share? And Doug was somebody who responded. First pack was in a small town in Michigan in 1977. We got a few from a grocery store, all hoping for Tigers. I got LaFleur and Staub, although and thought I hit the lottery. Still wish it was a Fidrich, though. That was the big name back then, the bird, of course, Mark Fidrich. But, still, you got LaFleur and Staub in his glory days, too. So that's a great story there. And again, to my point, now, Doug, we're talking 40-plus years later, and you still remember that day that you went to the store and bought a few packs and you hit a couple of players from your hometown team. Great story here from Philly Puck Fan regarding hockey cards. It says, first pack of hockey cards or any cards were 79-80 OPG. Pulled a Wayne Gretzky rookie. Still have it. Found it when I was helping cleaning mom's house for a move. It might be a PSA 2, but after wondering where it was for 50 years, I'll never sell. And he actually includes a picture. And it might be a PSA 2, honestly. It's in pretty good shape there. But, a Wayne Gretzky rookie card, and that 79-80 set's a beaut, by the way. That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. One more from Robert J. Lawson. Got my first pack at age 9 while on vacation in Watsonville, California, summer of 87. I happily pulled a Dwight Gooden, one of my favorites at the time, along with Garvey, Gwynn, Goose, and Reggie. 87 Tops is still my all-time favorite set. That's very similar to my 89 Tops story, getting those first packs of cards. You remember how old you were. You remembered where you were. And you remembered the cards that you pulled. And that's a great memory there. And that's one of the fun things about collecting is that regardless of the book value of a card, regardless of, what grade a paid grader puts on the card, regardless of what the market conditions are, everybody has a great story from the first days of when they were collecting. So again, I'll throw it out there and we'll share some stories in our next podcast, which will be 2 weeks from today on January 25th. What is the first memory that just pops into your mind about collecting cards when you were a kid? So again, it doesn't have to be the most valuable card you pulled. It doesn't have to be the first, rookie card you got. I mean, that may be part of the story. Just when I say, go back to when you first started collecting, what's the first memory that comes out of your mind? I would like to share some of those stories. So share those stories at Wax and Gum Stains at your convenience, and we will share them with our fans again 2 weeks from today, January the 25th. Well, that'll do it for this episode. My thanks to everybody who participated. Like I said, a couple of great questions, some really good topics about the brand that survived the junk wax era the longest. about why some 50s and 60s cards are valued less than what you may have paid for them decades ago. But as a buyer, this is a hell of a time to buy vintage cards. And again, as time marches on, these things get older and older, and the population very slowly gets smaller and smaller. So I would just say, you know, if you got a few bucks, get your hands on some of the vintage stuff just to have it. You know, it's a great time to buy the old stuff there. And then, of course, talking about those memories. And I really, when I saw that, it's just so funny. You know, you're talking about a set that was released 40 plus years ago, and you remember the first time you saw it and where it was and, you know, how you collected it. It's one of the great stories from a collector, and we would certainly like to hear more. So share them at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed. Also, make sure if you have a few extra bucks and you're not going out and buying that vintage stuff, make a donation to Wax Ecstatic via our PayPal page. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. paypal.me/waxecstatic, and we will go out and get some vintage cards to share and some packs to open up and talk about in future shows. The next show coming up 2 weeks from today, January the 25th, noon Eastern, it will go out via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining us for another edition of Wax Ecstatic, and we'll see you next time.